Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin. When we think about the Beatles, there is one date that stands out above all others, and I think we can all agree that date is August the 23rd. We all celebrate August the 23rd as a Beatle fan, and it's a magical day, isn't it, Stephen?
It is a magical day. It's Beatle Day.
It is Beatle Day. And what we are trying to do is, it's always interesting how the Beatles changed so quickly year on year, that progression that they made. But the question we were kind of asking ourselves was, is there a date across all the years of the 60s that seems to be a significant one in Beatle history?
Yes, and I tasked you with the job of finding that date.
And I have tasked myself and responded by saying I think the date is August the 23rd.
It had better be August the 23rd.
Well, we a few years ago we did our Beatles at Christmas episodes, and that's a nice way of kind of packaging up their yearly work. But August the 23rd, when you pull it apart, so many fascinating things happen in and around and on August the 23rd. So our plan is, across these episodes, is to look at August the 23rd and do little Beatles snapshots.
One episode for each year.
Well, there are certain topics that do pop up and you could easily spend an hour talking on them. So I guess that's the whole point, isn't it? So what we're going to do is we're going to look at August the 23rd from 1960 to 1969 and see where the Beatles were at.
Let's do it.
That's a good concept, isn't it?
That's a good concept.
That's reasonable. So we're going to start in 1960. August the 23rd, 1960. If I was a Beatle, where would I be?
You would be in Hamburg in the Indra Club.
Okay. Having a good time?
You'd be having a great time. Hamburg, big lake, dirty streets.
Dirty people.
Dirty people. What's not to love?
Tuesday, the 23rd of August, 1960, the Beatles were 1 week into their first trip to Hamburg. So it is fascinating about how young they were at this time. So if you are looking at their ages, Stuart Sutcliffe is the eldest. He is 20. John is 19. Paul is 18. Pete Best is 18, for it is he. And George is 17 years of age.
It's crazy.
It is crazy. And they are 7 days into their first ever Hamburg visit, or as Mark Lewisohn calls it, the great 1960s punk fest.
Yes, and that's clearly what it is. This is the start of their 8 gazillion hours of training in Hamburg.
And, you know, the Beatles story moves so fast. The reality is that, you know, from the 1st of August to the end of August in 1960, they leave the month as a totally different band to the band that was there at the start of the month. So, you know, the one big change that happens is Pete Best appears.
Yes, so he's literally just joined in August. So they'd had various drummers. Pete is actually their fourth drummer in a 13-week period. So, you know, they're going through drummers faster than Spinal Tap. And they know they're off to Hamburg and they know they need a drummer. And arguably, that's why and how Pete gets the gig, because is it unfair to say they're desperate for a drummer?
Well, the kind of the Hamburg thing lands on them via Alan Williams, and they have a date where they're expected to leave and travel. And as you say, you know, Pete is like their fourth drummer in 3 months or thereabouts. And yeah, he is drafted in, you know, purely out of expediency because Hamburg is on the horizon. So they just need a guy. But, you know, Pete is kind of reasonably well known. They'd have seen him play.
They'd have seen him. So they see him play with a group called the Blackjacks at the Casbah, which is the club run by his mother. And that's on the 6th is when they see him there. And then on the 12th, Paul asks him to come along for an audition. But it's not really an audition because they've got no other choice. So it's a done deal, I think, as far as the Beatles are concerned. Pete thinks he's going for an audition, but he's got the job.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we've talked about Mona Best, Pete's mum, before that, you know, particularly when we had our chats with Rogue Best, that the Beatles are already involved in the Best family. You'd kind of wonder, actually, why did it take so long for Pete Best to, you know, he seems of an age and, you know, he's of the network. It's a wonder he didn't land earlier.
I think although he's part of that network, as you say, and his mother is running the club, he is apart. He is a kind of solitary. He does his own thing. You know, he's very into sport and physical fitness, and you couldn't say that any of the other three are into any of those things. So he's sort of there, but I think on the periphery, and they don't know him that well.
Yes, that's true. And I mean, that's kind of the legend of Pete Best, was that he was never really one of the John Paul George gang. He didn't speak the lingo, so to speak.
He was always on the outside. He was always the other one.
Yeah, yeah. So they travel on the 16th of August to Hamburg. They play their first gig in the Indra on the 17th. And this is, they are under kind of the cosh of Bruno Koschmider.
See what you did there?
Oh, yeah. No, I didn't see what I did there. But yeah. They are, yeah.
Yeah, so Bruno Koschmider has travelled. You know, there is a backstory there where Alan Williams had been in Hamburg. He tries to play Koschmider a tape. I can get you these bands from Liverpool. The tape is not working. It's corrupted in some way. Koschmider arrives in London initially looking for Alan Williams. He knows he's in England somewhere. So there's a sort of a backstory there. But basically, Alan Williams has put this package together. He's already sent bands to Hamburg. Howie Casey is there with Derry and the Seniors already. The Beatles, they all travel in a little van, and there's photographs online of them sort of partway through their trip, and John Lennon shoplifting a harmonica on his way there, et cetera, et cetera. So they arrive not really knowing what to expect. And you've got to remember that their only touring experience to this date has been sort of a few days, a week or so, with Johnny Gentle in Scotland, which by all accounts was pretty horrendous. You know, they were sleeping in, you know, bad digs. They weren't getting their money. They didn't have any money for food. They were relying on the sort of kindness of strangers as they went along. So that was a traumatic thing. But they just leap at the chance of going to Hamburg.
Yeah, that is the legend of the Beatles, obviously, is that Hamburg made them, and that they were by no means a professional outfit who were, you know, on paper, they would not have seemed up for the task of Hamburg, of these kind of 6-hour sessions of playing nightly, 6 nights a week to crowds of drunks. So, you know, it's unusual that it happened at all.
It is. And what you've got to remember is they weren't used to playing this length of set.
Yeah.
You know, the longest I think they'd played before was maybe 2 hours. But here they're expected to play between 4.5, 6 hours, a night in various shifts. They just aren't road ready for this. Yeah. And they have to learn very, very fast. One of the things they do is they resolve right at the beginning that, you know, across these sets, they're not going to repeat themselves across the set. So even though, you know, if you were playing in a bar for that length of time, you think, well, people are going to come in, stay for a while, leave, new people will come in. It doesn't matter if you repeat some songs. But they resolve right from the beginning that they're not going to do that. And this, as you say, is really the making of them.
Yeah. So they play their first gig on the 17th, which is the 20th anniversary of the first Nazi bombing of Liverpool.
They sent us bombs. We sent them the Beatles.
The Beatles. I'm now going to drop one of my favourite Beatle facts, which is the Sir Joseph Lockwood story. Do you know about this?
Go ahead.
So Sir Joseph Lockwood, if you're fans of the Beatle story, is kind of always portrayed as this avuncular head of EMI in the 1960s. So when the Beatles are trying to get stuff done, they have to bring it to Sir Joe to get him to sign off on it. But the amazing thing about Sir Joseph Lockwood is that, you know, he grew up in a sort of a flour mill background. That was his family background. But during the Second World War, he was in charge of measures to prevent bombings in the northwest of England. And it is quite possible his measures to divert bombings in and around Liverpool and Manchester and in the northwest impacted on the lives of the Beatles.
Very good.
Isn't that fascinating?
That's very good. But presumably he didn't stop the bombing on the 17th of August.
He didn't, no. But there is this legend that the Beatles were born to the sound of bombs in the background. And it's, it's always a bit, it's a bit of a myth that John was born in the middle of a bombing raid. But it is interesting that Sir Joseph Lockwood was involved in protecting Liverpool.
Got to just say, Jason, we were all born in the middle of a bombing campaign. Anyway,
a little bit of politics. The Bruno Koschmider is an interesting guy. He's kind of labelled as this old man at the time. He's only about 34 when the Beatles rock up.
Yes, George in Anthology specifically says he wasn't some young rock and roll entrepreneur. He was an old guy who'd been crippled in the war. He had a limp and didn't seem to know much about music or anything. We only ever saw him once a week when we tried to get into his office for our wages. So there's a sort of image of them trying to kick the door down to get their money. But yeah, he's an old guy at 35.
Yeah, he was born in 1926 in Gdansk and he only died in 2000, you know, so he got to live to see the legend unfold over many decades. So they spend their first night in Bruno's house.
Yes, all in the one bed. Not with Bruno, but right, okay. All in the one bed together. Yeah, there's no accommodation for them when they arrive. So he takes them to his house and you know they stay in a spare room and then they move into the Bambi Kino cinema, which is the stuff of legend as well.
Well, yeah, this is the other Beatles legend that it, as Paul says, we lived backstage in the Bambi Kino next to the toilets and you could always smell them. The room had been an old storeroom and there were just concrete walls and nothing else. No heat, no wallpaper, not a lick of paint and two sets of bunk beds with not very much covers, Union Jack flags. We were frozen. You know, something I've never heard anyone ask is why didn't they just go and look for somewhere else to live?
Yeah, or buy a blanket.
Yeah, a couple of blankets or a couple more flags.
Yeah.
It seems logical to me. Yeah, they never really took it upon themselves to say, well,
to better their condition.
Maybe we could get some cheap digs.
Yeah.
I know we talked in the Christmas episode about how they spent Christmas at the Seamen's Mission. They could have even
pretended to be sailors.
Exactly. But obviously, because they're living in a cinema, the cinema is also playing movies. So yes. They don't really have any peace.
No, so they're playing all night. So they're sort of getting back to bed, such as it is in the early hours of the morning. And then the cinema sort of kicks into life at 4 o'clock. So there's a movie at 4, 6:30, 9 p.m. And this is right next door. And people are using the toilets beside them. And yeah, why didn't they add that to the list of questions when Paul comes on?
Well, Paul says that Hamburg was 800 hours in the rehearsal room. But we do have a close personal friend, Howie Casey,
yes,
who was there right at the start.
He was. So, as I say, Howie Casey is already there with Derry and the seniors. He apocryphally tells Alan Williams, don't send the Beatles because you're going to spoil it for everybody else. But he recounts the last time he had seen them was at the Billy Fury audition, which was on the 10th of May, 1960, which ultimately led to the Johnny Gentle tour. But he said, they were terrible.
Mm.
But of course, at that time, Tommy Moore was the drummer. He didn't arrive. Johnny Hutch was sitting in. So it was a bit shambolic. But anyway, Harry Casey is playing at the Kaiser Keller. He goes down to see them and he says, my jaw went to the floor. There was such a difference to what I'd seen at the audition. There was something there, a spark, that extra little bit. We did a bit of harmony singing, but they were marvellous at it. They were stunning. You knew they were going places. Now, bear in mind, that's 3 months since he last saw them.
Yeah.
And really all that they've done without Pete Best is back Johnny Gentle.
Mm.
And he is saying over the course of those 3 months, they've changed from this shambolic outfit that he sees at the audition and is saying, don't send them, to what he's saying, yeah, you can see that their harmonies. And again, it's this point that they're focusing on the vocal arrangements.
And, August the 23rd is the seventh of 48 consecutive nights that they are playing in Hamburg. And as you said, because they're doing these long sets, they don't want to repeat themselves. You kind of wonder, when did they learn these songs? Are they learning them in front of the audience? Are they playing them? They must be doing some kind of ad hoc, live rehearsals.
Yeah, I think so. I think they're sort of learning on the fly. So they were always known for sort of trying to find obscure songs, B-sides of American singles and things like that. So they had a repertoire. But very, very quickly, George says in Anthology, we had to learn millions of songs because we'd be on for hours. Hamburg was really our apprenticeship, learning to play in front of people. So Carl Perkins has an album out. They just play his entire album. They play Johnny Burnett's album, Elvis's first LP, Buddy Holly's first LP, Gene Vincent's LP, where they do have songs like Ray Charles' What'd I Say. They spin that out for 15 minutes. John recounts, a 10-minute version of Baby Let's Play House, which is the song then that will influence Run For Your Life.
Yeah.
So it's a combination of learning new songs on the fly and extending the songs that they have.
I do love this notion that they played entire albums, or that they would, they would learn entire albums,
yeah,
from start to finish. That, if you're kind of reading into it, you can think, oh, they're learning about the magic of albums or song sequencing or collections of songs, that they valued the album.
It's a concept ahead of its time.
There you go. Yeah, but they kind of could see where the writing was for that. And then to quote Jürgen Vollmer, "I can't imagine that they would be any better than they were in Hamburg, any more energetic, any more giving it all. I think it was due to the atmosphere. This was authentic rock and roll, the raw sex appeal of it." And that's kind of almost the tragedy about Hamburg. I know we've got later on Star Club tapes, but it is lost to the ether.
Yes. So until you invent the time machine.
Is the question, well, where would I go back to if it had to be Beatle related? Or because I might go back to somewhere else.
Oh, I see. Right, okay.
Where would I go back?
The origins of ELO or something.
Well, yes, I'm only human.
King Crimson, Hyde Park, 69.
Yes, that's true. I think if I had to choose a spot to see them, yeah, that would be good. Although, you know, it's obviously pre-Ringo Beatles.
Yeah. But,
It would certainly give you a better idea, particularly if I could bring a video camera and then bring that video back to the modern day.
You could go back with some money and hire them a proper hotel.
Yes.
But and then you'd be in their inner circle. You'd be, you know.
Yeah, but then they mightn't have the hunger and we just would have, you know, it's like one of these butterfly effect things.
You're saying it's sleeping under a Union Jack is what spurred them to greatness.
Anyway,
moving on.
Hamburg is still, you know, making money off the Beatles. They say the Indra.
Aren't we all?
Indra, where the Beatles played first, is the current tourist board claim. I haven't been to Hamburg.
We should go to Hamburg.
We should organize
a trip to Hamburg.
Yes. My
other very close personal showbiz friend, Tom Holland, wants to go to Hamburg.
Oh, really? So, yeah. My dad regularly goes to Hamburg for work reasons, and he kind of constantly tells me about all the stuff I should be seeing over there. Anyway, so that's 1960, August the 23rd, 1960, end of week one in Hamburg. It's John, Paul, George, Stu and Pete working the Indra, living in a grotty room, and wondering where it's going to go next, figuring out how to fill out 6 hours of gigs per night.
Yes.
So let's skip forward 1 year to August the 23rd, 1961. And now we are in the thick of Cavern Beatles.
It's a Wednesday.
It is a Wednesday.
I know that's usually your line.
and, you know, the difference is, you know, if 1960 is Hamburg Beatles, 1961 is really Cavern Beatles.
Yes. So this is really, I suppose, in the popular consciousness, this is where the Beatles start.
Yes. And it's still John, Paul, George and Pete.
Yes. So Stuart has stayed in Hamburg.
And on this particular day, Wednesday, August the 23rd, 61, they are doing lunchtime and evening gigs at the Cavern. So they make their debut in the Cavern back on the 9th of February, 1961. And they kind of take to it pretty naturally.
They do. The amusing thing is George turns up in jeans and they won't let him in.
This is on the first date
First day.
He has to kind of convince them that he's with the band.
Yes, yes. Because if you wear jeans, you don't mind getting them dirty, so you don't mind having a fight. That's the logic.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so if you turn up in jeans, you're ready for a scrap.
Is that why I'm wearing jeans today?
I hope not.
I'm ready for a scrap. Yeah, and it was George had to convince the bouncer, Paddy Delaney, that he was with the band. Paddy Delaney, he's from home, I'd say.
He's from home.
Absolutely.
Give the Beatles back to the Irish, that's what I say.
Yeah, there's a show in that, I think.
I believe so.
Yes, on BBC Sounds. The first show that they play there, they're playing from 1 to 2 p.m. and they're given a £15 fee to share between them. And we might laugh at that, but you stick that in the inflation calculator, it's just over 250 quid.
It's decent money.
It is decent money. I mean, when you think about, you know, live music in this day and age, you know, there's nobody picking up 250 quid for an hour long lunchtime gig. It's all do it for free and we'll give you
free.
The exposure.
Yeah.
but that's kind of the money they were making. And it's not bad money. It beats proper work.
Beats proper work.
Hmm. Yeah. They're doing a couple of those gigs per week and they're bringing down money. They progress from lunchtime shows to evening shows. So they do their first evening show on the 21st of March, 1961. And, you know, by the time we get to the 23rd of August, these bookings, we don't have Brian on the scene yet. So it's Pete and Mona Best who are still involved in this.
It is. I mean, you know, John, Paul, George, not interested in the business side. I mean, they're quite happy to leave that to Pete. So even though you have that core three who are very tight and have that friendship, they're they're just not interested in the business side at all. So they're quite happy for Pete to do that. And his mother is, I think at this stage, Mona is sort of a de facto manager.
It does, if you kind of look in that pattern of behavior, that's kind of true across the entire decade.
Yeah.
That John, Paul and George, and then eventually Ringo, they just want to rock up and do the work and be the band. So kind of Brian eventually comes into the slipstream. And, you know, for the Brian years, he's basically like, OK, Beatles, turn up and do this here, do this here, do this here.
Yeah. So what you're saying is they need a Mona, a Brian or a Klein.
A Klein. Well, you see, Klein didn't do that. Isn't that the... And then we're not going to go back.
Klein,
back
to part seven.
Klein anyway. But that's where they responded best. They didn't. They wanted to be in an environment where they didn't have to think about that.
Exactly.
They could just do the creativity, the gigs, the recordings, the play. And so this is a little window into how they are going to be.
Exactly. And the other person who has arrived is Neil Aspinall.
Yeah, they're slowly, it's like watching the start of an action movie where the crew are slowly coming
slowly
together.
Assembling.
Yeah, Neil is driving the 65-pound van. That's £1,150 in modern money. Again, a very affordable way to make music.
Well, exactly. But they are, I think, the only band in Liverpool at the time that have their own driver.
That's pretty wild.
And that this is the van, if you people would like to refer back to our Rogue Best episode where Rogue was explaining that Mona said to Neil, I'll buy the van for £65 and you can, well, we'll sort something out, I think was how Rogue put it.
Right, and they certainly did. But Rogue wasn't born for another 12 months or so, July 1962. At this point, if you go see the Beatles, they are not in their suits, they are the leathery Beatles.
Yes, they look like hooligans, according to George.
Mm. And this lunchtime show is their 28th lunchtime show at the Cavern and 38th show overall. And I do think it's, I know I've said this before, it is quite an odd notion that, what shall we do over lunch? Let's go see a gig.
I was just about to say that. You know, if Inhaler were playing in the centre of Dublin, would you go and see them? Well, you wouldn't.
Well, no, I wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't go and see Inhaler. Anyway. But if some other band...
If a band I liked.
Yes, if a band you liked was playing in Dublin, would you sort of go down every...
Well, the closest thing that happens is there are lunchtime concerts by symphony orchestras.
Yes, yeah, so that's very,
which happens
very civilized.
In Dublin, which is very nice and proper. But, you know, to actually go see, you know, cutting edge... You know, rock and roll or, you know, whatever cutting edge music. Well, I don't know what cutting edge music is in 2022, Stephen. It's still the Beatles, right?
That's it. I think that's right. we do have, in Belfast, we have a thing called Out to Lunch.
Okay.
Which is a spin-off of sort of a fest, but it's more like a festival thing, you know, where they put comedians and bands and things on. But it's not, it's known bands who are touring and then they have a little gig and they put these concerts on. And we have the Ulster Orchestra will play, but this is sort of an unknown local band.
Yeah, it's an underground club,
yeah.
Basically. You know, like people eulogise places about CBGBs, but this is a 1961 CBGBs in the northwest of England that nobody's really paying attention to. It has always been an odd part of the Beatles story that they had to work so hard to get noticed in London.
I'm not sure this is happening anywhere else.
There is. The only other time I've really come across was I read a book about Roxy Music, and Brian Ferry used to perform in the 60s with, there'd be soul bands playing lunchtime gigs.
Oh, okay.
And that's the only kind of similar kind of vibe. But again, that's in, you know, north of England, albeit on the other northeast. That's kind of the only kind of story I've heard that kind of sounds like the Beatles story. So how, you know, if they are doing a lunchtime gig, how would their day have played out on August the 23rd, 1961?
I feel like I'm sitting on a sofa for Good Morning. And what would the Queen be doing? Well, first of all, it's Pete and Neil. They have access to the van. The equipment is stored in the van. So they arrive, you know, around 11 o'clock, take the equipment down the steps into the club, and then John, Paul and George, they arrive, you know, half an hour later, so they don't have to do any of the heavy lifting. And they're all travelling from different parts of Liverpool. They're travelling in separately and they're all travelling by bus. And when I say Pete and Neil have the equipment, the one piece that they don't have is George's black Gretsch guitar, which he acquires in July. And he is like super glued to this guitar. He will not let this guitar out of his sight.
Well, it costs £90, which is more than the van.
Yes, but he only paid £70. He paid £70 up front, £20 on an IOU, and he still owes that £20 to this day.
Well, I think he's probably resolved of that debt. The Cavern stage was famously only about a foot and a half off the ground, and they would play almost eyeball to eyeball, looking down at the audience, and the audience would interact and they would cheer and they would hand up requests and all the rest.
This is the camaraderie they develop with that audience. And you know, the audience is made up of schoolgirls, office workers, clerks, you know, people that live in the or working in the vicinity of the club. You know, this is a commercial street in Liverpool. And this is, you know, if you read Mark Lewisohn's book, he is very good at documenting the friendship that develops between members of the band and members of the audience.
You know,
quite innocent friendships between these guys who are playing and sort of 15, 16-year-old girls who are sort of skipping school at lunchtime to go to the Cavern.
And the club itself, what was that like?
Well, we have descriptions, and the one thing that comes out of everybody's description is it absolutely stank.
It does not, like, we have been to the Cavern in Liverpool as it is now.
Yes.
Which is a rebuilt, reconstructed, fake, touristy.
Fake is the word you're looking for.
No, it's got the authentic vibe.
Of course.
It's got the arches and everything, but amazingly, they demolished the original Cavern. Hard to believe. But the new Cavern does not smell.
No.
It's very touristy.
It's very touristy. But if they put some rotting vegetable, some BO, some toilets, and the smell of Thelma's snack bar hot dogs.
Mmm. Good old Thelma. And it's also dangerous. I mean, health and safety have ruined everything, Stephen.
Health and safety have ruined everything. So, it is. If you were claustrophobic, I think you absolutely would not want to be there. So, I think it was a death trap. And it was officially a death trap. So in May 1961, there were 15 people were killed in a fire in a club in Bolton. Mm. Now, it was a different setup. It was an upstairs room. But it prompted a public inquiry. And we have a description of the Cavern from that report. So it is 11 feet below ground. You go down 17 slippery stone steps. It is 58 feet by 39 feet with a stage at one end.
It's so small.
Tiny.
It's
and at so lunchtime, small. They cram 200 to 300 people in there at lunchtime. And you think that's appalling. But in the evening, they get 500 to 600 people in there in a space which is less than 60 feet by 40 feet and has to accommodate a stage.
Wow, yeah.
And the report concludes it has a, quote, utterly inadequate means of escape.
Well, totally imaginable if it's 17 slippery stone steps 11 feet underground to try and get out.
And the one thing they said was in its favour was there was nothing to catch fire, you know, because it was stone.
It's stone,
and
it was, yeah.
And you think that's not a good enough, because we have reports of sort of the sweat running down the walls and
there's no ventilation in the place.
There's no ventilation and the electrics are shorting and the toilets are overflowing and, you know, so there's loose electrical cables and water, shall we say, on the floor. it's mad.
But yet for, you know, a significant part of 1961, it's the Beatles' home. And, you know, on this day, as we said, they were playing lunchtime and evening time shows. So John, Paul and George would just go to the pub. Pete and Neil would usually go home.
Yeah.
And they'd pass a few hours and then they'd go back in for the evening show.
Yeah, so they're sitting in the grapes, George clutching his gretch.
Mm.
And again, this idea that, you know, well, we know why Neil is going home, but Pete is going home. And again, it's this continuing sense of separateness.
Yeah.
You know, he's not part of the band.
Yeah, it is odd. And then the evening show is their 11th evening show. And what's notable is that they are topping the bill. They are a draw. So you're saying 500 to 600 people, you know, coming in to these evening time gigs when they're packed. And it's, you know, they're topping a bill with support from the Rockin' Black Cats and Carl Vincent and the Counts. Said that right? It's, you know, but it's an odd time for the band because even though they have their Hamburg thing going, they are ensconcing themselves in the Cavern. They're not really...
They're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And Bob Wooler, who is a sort of compere in the Cavern, he is adamant that around this time, this sort of summer period, they were on the point of splitting up, that they felt they'd got to a certain point, but they were stuck and they needed something to come along, something to happen to break out of this. And they did not see any way of doing this themselves, or at least they weren't capable, didn't feel capable of moving up from where they were.
That is a thing about them, that there was honest ambition.
Yes, I mean, they were always driving forward. They were always waiting for the next big thing. Mm. But they are strangely, you know, they're not authors of their own destiny often. Mm. They are literally just saying, well, something will happen. Something will happen. And it
It does. It does happen. But it's hard to get a sense of what the ambition was maybe amongst their peers. There seemed to be a lot of people maybe just happy to play the circuit. I'm sure lots of people dreamt of being a big, famous rock star. But even at this point, the Beatles seemed to be, a little bit on trying to forge their own path. And I don't know how much of that is just us kind of looking at it in retrospect. But they did seem to have is it preposterous to say a sense of destiny?
I mean, John, I think, has a sense of destiny.
Mm.
But, you know, everybody can have a sense of destiny.
Well, I think we all have
a sense of destiny to some degree. But I think there just seems to be a confidence that something will happen. And they're always, they never look to plan. You know, again, this is another point that Mark Lewisohn makes, is they never plan anything.
No.
They don't have a strategy. It's not that they sit down and, with a pencil and paper and they work out, well, what we must do is this and this and this and this. And that doesn't start happening until Brian Epstein appears. But even then, they aren't really involved in that.
But if you're talking about how do they manifest the destiny, you know, you could say John did it by bringing Paul in and then bringing George in, that he, you know, debatably felt that these people were necessary.
I think there is a sense, yes, there is a sense that John is driving it forward, and there is definitely a sense that they are not like other bands, that they're not going to be content playing the Cavern, no matter how good the money is, playing the Butlins summer seasons, mm-hmm. going back and forward to Hamburg, you know, ending up on a cabaret circuit or something. This is not what they want.
But they never actually go down that route. That's an interesting point. Like, it's all for the cause of group-based rock and roll. The Cavern, Hamburg, all the associated gigs. They never actually go down the route of doing a Butlins summer camp or family entertainment or any of that things, which some of their peers do. So they are staying true to that rock roots vibe.
I think they are different in that respect. So, you know, Rory Storm does that. The Remo 4 are off playing in army bases. Mm. You know, they just don't do that.
Yeah. So this is August the 23rd, 1961, lunchtime and evening gigs at the Cavern. But again, as the crew is coming together in the background, August 1961 is also when Brian Epstein writes his first column for Merseybeat magazine. So, you know, this thing is formulating a scene. The people are coming into this scene and Brian is kind of in the wings.
That's the closing scene of the first half of the movie, I think.
And I think it's the closing scene of the first half of this episode. We'll take a break and we'll be right back.
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. August the 23rd, 1962 was a Thursday, and it is the day that John and Cynthia Lennon got married.
Yes, and we've done an episode on that, so 1963.
Well, we have, but it's in our Acast Plus realm. We probably should touch upon it again, because they get married on August the 23rd, 1962. Were they planning to get married a day or two earlier? Like, it comes very, very quickly, this wedding.
It's very, very quick. So the day before, on the 22nd of August, Cynthia sees her mother off to Canada. She's not present for the wedding. And the night before that night, John tells Aunt Mimi that he's getting married in the morning.
And she is takes it well?
She's delighted.
She is not.
Delirious. Sorry, I couldn't read my own writing.
She flips out. You're too young. You're making a mess of your life. And this seems to be the next heartbreak in a series of heartbreaks that John causes Aunt Mimi.
Poor Mimi.
Poor Mimi. I mean, she's often cast as this bossy, matriarchal, difficult person, but she was trying to do her best.
Was she?
I think she
was. By the standards of her day, and all she got was a bungalow.
Well, the thing about Aunt Mimi is, you know, that there's a version of events where John doesn't make good of himself.
Yes.
And, is close to potentially being like Freddie Lennon.
He's 35 and still living with Aunt Mimi.
Yeah. So, you know, she...
This time next year, Mimi, we'll be millionaires.
Yeah, but only fools and horses. There's... I can see Aunt Mimi's concerns, and it's a very... She wouldn't have been the only parental figure of that time acting in that way, that kind of strict, here's how you should behave, here's what you should do, you're ruining things and reacting against the hooliganism and the yobs of the teenagers of the early 60s, etc.
I see you as an Aunt Mimi character.
Well, it is my parenting style. I do model myself on Aunt Mimi. But the reason, you know, and we did do a parallel episode about the relationship of the Ballad of John and Cynthia. You know, they've been, you know, they first met in 1957. So they've known each other for about 5 years through art college. They began a relationship in 1958. But the thing that brings the wedding to a head is that Cynthia is pregnant.
She fell pregnant.
She, yes.
I think that's what you did in 1960. You fell pregnant.
Yes, it was purely in the stars. They had never used contraception, apparently.
You've done the research.
Yes. And John's reaction when he finds out is that, well, we'll just have to get married.
We'll just have to get married.
Classic reaction.
That's what they do. That's what they do.
You know, that too was also a common thing that you did. You just got someone pregnant. You got married. That was it.
Yeah. And again, you know, when you read the story, one of the things I hated at school was having to read Charles Dickens, because the stories are full of coincidences and points at which, you know, things could have happened to derail the story. But this story is exactly the same.
Mm.
You know, and this is exactly one of those points where John gets married and settles down and leaves the band, and Paul goes off to, you know, write songs on his own and works with Lionel Bart, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this is a pivotal point. This is a huge change in John's circumstances.
Yes.
And July, August of 1962 is a big pivotal moment for the band, and this is just one of a series of things, and potentially it could derail their progress that suddenly started to happen.
Yes, and Mark Lewisohn has done his Evolver 1962 show, and he traces the year of 1962 from the 1st of January to the 31st of December. That's normally when years end.
Yes.
And you know, he basically sets it out as a propulsion, you know, that they are going through throughout that year. You know, they formally sign to NEMS on the 1st of July. On the 22nd of July, Mal comes on staff, and Queenie Epstein, Brian's mum and Brian's dad, see the Beatles at Cambridge Hall.
Yeah.
But it is this week that culminates on the 23rd of August. That is, you know, we talked about 1960. They're a different band from the 1st of August to the end of August 1960. They are a different band literally from the 16th of August to the 23rd of August 1962. Because on the 16th of August, Pete gets the boot.
Pete gets the boot and Ringo comes in.
Yeah, it is quite a busy week.
It is. And one of the reasons why they have to get rid of Pete in this time frame is they've got a TV appearance booked for the 22nd. So they do not want, they know that Pete is going to leave, put that kindly. So they've got to get him out of the band, and they've got to get Ringo in by the time the TV cameras arrive on the 22nd to film them at the Cavern. I mean, they absolutely do not want Pete there for that appearance.
They do not. And, you know, Pete leaves on the 16th. On the 22nd of August, it is this TV appearance. And this is the famous TV appearance of Some Other Guy.
Yes.
Where the Beatles are playing. So the crazy thing is that, you know, Ringo plays, you know, his first gig with them on August the 18th. So Pete is kicked out on the 16th. Johnny Hutchinson sits in on drums for you know, a gig at the River Park Ballroom. Ringo plays his first gig on the 18th of August. So that's when the Beatles were officially John, Paul, George and Ringo. They rehearse for 2 hours, apparently, before Ringo makes his live debut. But this 22nd of August gig is Some Other Guy. So Ringo's been in the band 4 days. We're very familiar with that footage as Beatles fans.
Yes.
And you have to look at it thinking, this is Ringo's fourth day in the band. Pete is in the room.
Oh, yeah, Pete is in the audience.
Why is Pete there?
He just goes to... Well, it makes the scene. If you were directing this movie, you'd have him in the audience, standing at the back.
Just sort of seething.
Just sort of seething. Or wistfully staring at the Delmas hot dog stand.
But it's, you know, it's full tilt, busy week. And at some point in this week, John and Cynthia decide to get married.
Yeah. And I say that's, it's a crazy week.
Mm.
It's a crazy week.
So while John and John Paul, George and Ringo are filming some other guy at the cavern on the 22nd, that's when Cynthia is getting her mother away off to Canada.
Go to Canada
because I've got something to do tomorrow. And then they have the day of the wedding itself. And Brian is very intimately involved in their lives at this point.
Yes, so he's sort of facilitating almost every aspect of their lives. And as we commented previously in this episode, you know, they're very happy to just hand over control to Brian. And Brian is a complete control freak. You know, we looked at this in the last season about his difficulty in delegating, and he's there at every step. And already he has this personal relationship with the boys.
Yes.
So, you know, he collects Cynthia on the day of the wedding to bring her to the wedding in his fancy Ford Zodiac, which is a lovely car, except someone's covered it with a paint stripper.
And this could be to do with Brian's
secret life.
Yes, his alter ego, the things that must not be known.
Yes, there are two possibilities that are always talked about. One is that it's a fan of Pete.
Oh, right.
You know, has thrown paint stripper on the car, but it seems more likely that this is in some way related to Brian's secret life.
Hmm. And the wedding has John present, obviously, but Paul and George are there.
Yeah.
Ringo is not there, but then this is Ringo's fifth day in the band.
Yes.
And, you know, perhaps hasn't graduated into the nexus of John, Paul and George yet.
No,
they're still treating him like a Pete.
Yes, he's probably having a lie down after appearing on TV the day before. I mean, that must have been quite a trajectory.
That's good fun. You know, yeah. You think this band is going places if you're on telly.
Yeah, but Ringo isn't there. Neil isn't there.
Mm.
Neil, I suppose at this stage, Neil is very close to the Best family and is best mates with Pete.
Well, he's also a dad. He's just become a dad.
Yeah. And it's that really. You have a sense, I think, or I have a sense that they're perhaps a little bit unsure how that is going to play out with Neil. And Pete recounts that, you know, after he is fired, he goes back home. Neil is there. And he sort of is saying to Neil, what are we going to do now? And Neil is saying, what do you mean we? You know, I'm still employed by them. I'm still,
so,
and I think from the Beatles' point of view, there must have been a little bit of an uncertainty there as to how Neil Aspinall was going, which way he was going to jump, I suppose.
And at the wedding itself, Cynthia's brother and his wife are there. His wife's Marjorie, and she is a witness along with Paul McCartney of the wedding. So, you know, John and Paul, very close. And then they head off to lunch afterwards.
Yes. So only five of them go to lunch. So Cynthia's brother and wife, they're not invited to lunch. And they go to somewhere called Reese's Restaurant. And this is directly opposite a sort of enormous pub or sort of alehouse called The Vines, where coincidentally Alf and Julia Lennon had their reception 24 years previously.
Yeah, it's so close, 24 years. There's no pictures of the event, so
That's crazy.
Like Mike McCartney was just there. Like they could have just asked Mike to come along.
Yeah.
He was taking pictures of washing lines and all sorts of stuff.
Yes.
Like, really? Was he busy?
He must have been.
I find that hard to believe. And one of my favourite facts that you've told me is that there were no gifts.
Yes.
And this is the Beatles never gave each other gifts.
No, this is a thing. They never give each other presents.
And I was racking my brains thinking, surely they must have given each other gifts at some point. But no, send letters and postcards. But I can't think of any Beatles presents.
The only thing that I can think of is where it's John's 30th birthday and George turns up in the studio and he's recorded Johnny's birthday for him and he gives him a kind of plastic flower that he's taken from the dashboard of his car. I mean, and that's not really a gift, that's a kind of joke.
Yeah.
So I think from the very earliest point there seems to have been a decision, well, we just not give each other gifts.
That's weird, yeah. It's this notion of them as a unit. They would receive gifts as a band. They would give gifts as a band. But, yeah, they never gave each other.
No.
They were each other's presents, too.
That's probably what they were thinking. But, Brian, you know, Brian will give them gifts.
Yeah.
You know, Mark Lewisohn talks about the, you know, alarm clocks and things that travel clocks that Brian is giving them. So it works that way. But, no, between themselves. Oh, is that embarrassing? Did, you know, first Christmas, did Ringo turn up with arms full of presents?
I bought loads of aftershave. I'll just have to drink it. John said, I did feel embarrassed about being married, walking around married. It was like walking about with odd socks or your flies open. Okay, that's one way of looking at it, I suppose. And then they go off on honeymoon. No, they don't. No.
They go and play a gig.
They go and play a gig. So this thing is so slapdash, so last minute that there is a gig in the evening time. Where do they go?
They go to the River Park Ballroom in Chester.
And this is a recurring gig they have in August 1962. So for each Thursday in 1962, they are playing, or for a number of Thursdays, they're playing the River Park Ballroom in Chester. So this was the second of four.
Yeah. And again, they're topping the bill. The support act is the Remo 4. Mm-hmm. And I looked up some stuff about the Remo 4.
Tell me all about the Remo 4. How many were in the band?
There were four.
Great. Any other facts?
They signed to NEMS in 1963. Mm-hmm. Tommy Quickley, Dirk McQuickley.
Yes.
Tommy Quickley becomes their lead singer and they record Tip of My Tongue.
Oh, yes.
Which is a sort of Paul McCartney, I suppose a Lennon McCartney, but it's a Paul song. And then they cross paths again with the Beatles in 1967 when George hires them to perform on the Wonderwall soundtrack alongside Eric Clapton and Peter Tork and that thing. And Tony Ashton joins them briefly.
Who's Tony Ashton? Oh, here I go. I've let the sign down, have I?
Tony Ashton, he's a keyboard player, and he starts moving in circles, sort of Deep Purple circles, Whitesnake.
Okay.
And you must have heard of Pace Ashton
yes,
Lord.
Yes, yes, I have.
Which
yes.
featured your good friend and
Bernie
mine,
Marston.
Bernie Marston.
Fan of the show.
Fan of the show.
Now I'm embarrassed that Bernie heard me say that.
You're the wrong age.
I guess so. But when the Remo 4 are doing the support on that night, John has a bit of a bee in his bonnet. Like, he's not the happy married man. He's still angry.
He's still angry John Lennon. So he is reportedly furious that the Remo 4 are performing in their set some songs that the Beatles have in their set. And he walks on stage demanding to know if they're going to play anymore.
While they are playing the gig.
While they are playing. So a member of the band says, the ballroom was long and thin and the dressing room was to the right of the stage. Halfway through our set, mid-song, John Lennon jumped up on the stage and yelled at us, how many of our fucking songs are you going to play? You think this is where you would take your time machine. You'd want to see that.
You would want to see that, you know. And they're playing gigs. And so, you know, the 23rd of August becomes John's wedding anniversary.
Yes.
Which doesn't really seem to get a look in on any other 23rd of August ever.
No, you don't hear about parties or big celebrations or...
Yeah. Or, yeah. You know, I'm going to finish early. I'm going to...
Yeah, got to take the wife.
Going to go out for an Indian.
Yeah.
None of that happens. But August the 23rd, 1962, as we have said, wraps up a very tumultuous week in the life of the Beatles. They go from being John Paul, George and Pete, to John Paul, George and Ringo. They make their first television appearance. They get married and they are gigging like the Clappers.
They get married. The Beatles all get married. In a way.
That's my fan fiction.
In a way, they all get married.
That would happen.
I think in the movie that we will be directing, this is, if you wrote that and pitched it, they would say, no, that's unbelievable that all of that happened in that... that space of time.
What a busy day. I've gotten married, I've had a boozy lunch, and now I'm having a fight with the Remo 4. Like, that's a year.
That's
in my
a year
world
in your world
to get all of that done. I do like that notion that he kind of just wanders on stage and then has a starts taking them to task.
Do you think he was channeling his aggression from the marriage?
What have I done?
It finally caught up with him.
That is a full day by the time the sun goes down and they put their heads on the pillow on August the 23rd, 1962. So we are going to continue looking at August the 23rd in our next episode, which 1962, what year comes after 1962?
That's 1963.
Well done. And on Friday, the 23rd of August, 1963, this is the day that She Loves You is released in the UK. See, August the 23rd is quite a date.
Well done. You did your research. I'm very, very proud.
So it's a good way to celebrate your first wedding anniversary by releasing She Loves You. But we are going to talk about that next time. We remain available in all the usual places. We are on Twitter at BeatlesPod. We have the Nothing Is Real Facebook group. We have the website that ties everything together, www.nothingisrealpod.com. There's Instagram, TikTok, Mastodon, all the places where we vaguely exist. And we're always happy to interact and talk at any point in time. But for now, my name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.